So we're thinking about the subject of worship. Our interest for the next four Sundays has been our worship of God. Now, I deliberately say that that can sound rather the opposite of our practical application in Deuteronomy. It's only a deliberate say, because, of course, one of the main points of God's laws is that you couldn't and shouldn't separate out the things you did before God from your everyday life. For Israel, all of life was to be holy. Notice in this text how a fundamental part of Israel's worship was to enjoy the blessings of everyday life before God. And in the New Testament, for New Testament believers, all of life is intended to be worship and sacrifice to God. We shall see how some of that works out in future weeks. But tonight, I do want us to focus in on what we specifically do together as our acts of worship in our church services, for instance, on a Sunday. Now, isn't it interesting that worship is the most important activity of the church? It is also one of the things that's most contentious, too. There's a wide range of churches in our city for newcomers to come to when they arrive, and for oldcomers to swap around as well. I'd like to think that people base their decisions on the quality and the content of the teaching, or maybe on the reality of relationships and love, or the passion of evangelism. But to be honest, I think the single biggest factor these days upon which people based their decision is very often the style of worship that they find at different churches. And of course, that is not an irrelevant consideration at all. That's not a silly thing to be concerned about. Worship is important, and worship is closely related to theology and to relationships and to mission to the rest of the world. But it does strike me that decisions are often made on the basis of preferences rather than on the basis of any principles. Yet principles for these things do exist in scriptures. They don't tie us down in every respect, but there are principles that should guide our worship as much as they guided that of ancient Israel. So we better have a look and see what they actually are. Now, tonight we're looking at what you might call the exclusivity, the focus of Israel's worship, that they should worship God alone, and in particular, in the passage we've read, they should worship God in one special place. Now, that, of course, was physically quite possible when God's people were in a small, unified nation. It wasn't easy, but it was possible. Nowadays, of course, God's people are scattered worldwide, all around the world, no longer centered in one holy place. So how on earth do we apply this Old Testament pattern or picture into a New Testament context? Well, we've already read two passages from John's Gospel that give us the key to understanding it nowadays. First of all, we read the account of Jesus cleansing the temple, didn't we? Sweeping out all of the traders and so on. And then we read that the fulfillment of the one place for worship in ancient Israel was Jesus Christ himself. He started talking about the temple of his body, didn't he? The temple he spoke of was his body. He knew that soon that building would be obsolete and that he would be the place in which people should worship. So that one place in ancient Israel was the shadow, and Jesus Christ is the fulfillment. Then second, in that debate with the woman at the well, Jesus answers her query about the correct place for worshipping God by making it clear that now he, Jesus Christ, has come. It's no longer about worshipping God on a mountain, on a temple, or any other special place. God is spirit, said Jesus, and his worshippers must worship in spirit and in truth. In spirit and in truth. Now this, I find, is a text which is often quoted to lots of different purposes and not often clearly explained. What does it mean? I'll do my best. The contrast is between the outward ceremonies and signs and symbols of Old Testament religion and the reality is the fulfillment in Jesus Christ himself. So he's saying no longer will worship be about making the right external moves in the right place, on a temple or on a mountain or wherever. Now it's about the reality of God himself, his spirit, his living presence. God is spirit, not represented or mediated by signs and symbols and sacrifices, but now alive in the heart of those who believe him and know him and love him. And parallel with that, the truth. That is the authentic revelation of his character and of his will. The shadows swept away, the reality seen and known through the scriptures and alive by the Spirit. And again, both spirit and truth point to Jesus Christ himself, because Jesus gives the Spirit. He is the Spirit of Christ. And Jesus is the truth. So in talking about worshipping in spirit and truth, Jesus is making a contrast between the outward symbols and the reality of God himself, who's not bound in places or anything else like that. So here is the basic format which we can read the Old Testament worship pattern and find something helpful and useful for us in our different setting. When it talks about worshipping God in one special place, according to the ceremonial laws of Moses, we should put on our New Testament glasses and think of worshipping God, not in one place, but through one person, through Jesus, and doing so in spirit and in truth. The living reality of God himself, not the shadow. That's the way we should think of this. With that in mind, we can helpfully then wind back to the text we've read in Deuteronomy and see more of what our worship, authentic Christian worship, really should be. Now, I'd like to highlight three principles I think we can draw from this text. They are that worship should be exclusive, that worship should be authentic, and that worship should be united. Worship should be exclusive, authentic, and united. Exclusive, first of all, then. Israel was to worship Yahweh, the one true God, and him alone. And that was more important than archaeology. Verse 2. Destroy completely all the places on the high mountains and on the hills and under every spreading tree where the nations you are dispossessing worship their gods. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, and burn their Asherah poles in the fire. Cut down the idols of their gods and wipe out their names from their places. And no doubt the curators of the British Museum are utterly horrified at such a thought like that. In fact, most people today would be horrified by such a thought as that. It sounds like the Taliban, doesn't it? What cultural Philistines, we would say. And of course, nowadays, we are under no such obligation to go and burn down the British Museum, you know. But in ancient Israel, it was a different matter. All traces of the Canaanite gods had to be removed. They had to be removed. Just look at verse 31 to see why they had to be got rid of. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way, because in worshipping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire as sacrifices to their gods. Those are high places and so on. They were not quaint archaeological relics. They were appalling places of abuse and savagery. They were terrible. That's what the gods were like. They weren't real gods at all, just perversions, demonic in their sense. In Israel, there was to be only one God worthy of worship. And the exclusivity of that worship was preserved by getting rid of all those diverse places and focusing the worship on one place. Notice it wasn't the place itself that was special, but rather that God had chosen to put his presence at that place. There was nothing magic about the temple in Jerusalem, for instance, but God had chosen that that would be his place. Verse 5, you are to seek the place the Lord your God has given you. From among all the tribes, you have put his name there to dwell. Deuteronomy does not say that where this place was going to be. And in fact, we found that God put his name in several different places first. For instance, Shiloh, before it settled long-term in Jerusalem. So the key thing was not that there was one special place, but who was going to be in that place. That's what made the place special. So how do we apply this to ourselves? Well, remember now it is not about places. The key to understanding it is through Jesus, in spirit and in truth. Of course, as Christians, we seek to be good neighbours to whoever God places alongside us within our community. It's most definitely not our business to torch the local mosque or raid the Hindu temple. Of course not. But nor is it our business to blur the distinctions either. So if we authentically want to follow Christ, we don't take part in so-called interfaith worship. The reason for that is we don't believe that such a thing exists. There's no such thing as interfaith worship. It just doesn't exist. Much of the rest of the world tells us that we all worship the same God, but the simple fact is we don't. Our God is known in and through Jesus Christ and him alone. If we believe that is true, then it is not a sign of respect to other people to compromise on it. In fact, if we believe it's true, then it's incredibly patronizing and deceitful to other people to sort of pat them on the head and pretend we think that their worship, their religion is equally valid, when really we don't. Some people say we should have interfaith worship in order to evangelize other people, but I think that's an appalling, deceitful thing to do. Utterly disrespectful for people from other faiths to do that. Far better to talk with them, get to know them and explain our differences than to go through a pretense of sharing a faith. And of course, if we don't believe that Jesus is unique, then why do we call ourselves Christians? Why do we say we belong to him? So that's the obvious application, if you like. But I think we need to be a bit more subtle about this too. The other gods of our Western world are not limited to other religions. They helpfully declare themselves with a sign on the temple door. They maintain that distinction as relatively straightforward, and a great many of them understand completely why we shouldn't have interfaith worship, because they operate on the same principles. The greater threats to true worship in Christian churches are more subtle gods and idols of our culture, because what they tend to do is insinuate themselves unacknowledged into our thoughts and into our aspirations without us quite realizing it's happening. And this brings us to our next point. God placed his holy name in one place because worship should be authentic as well as exclusive. Look again at verse 4. It says, you must not worship the Lord your God in their way. You see, it's saying not just don't worship other gods, but also don't worship God in their way as well. Don't use their techniques and methods. For instance, the pagans sought to make their gods visible through idols and images. The pagans sought to make their gods amenable and on side through appeasing them, through buying them off, through entertaining them or doing disgusting or wicked things. The pagans sought to make their gods tangible by religion that excited and thrilled or indeed instilled fear and loathing in the people there. And the danger was that Israel might start adopting methods like that, even when trying to worship God himself. So by centering worship in one place, the Lord ensured, or at least it was helped to ensure, that his worship would always be according to his way of doing things, as well as being towards him. Now, is there a danger like this today? Well, yes, I think so, most certainly. But we must be subtle and careful in identifying it. Because in the New Testament, things have changed. In the New Testament, the culture, the danger does not lie in the fact that people have various and different cultures. In the New Testament, that's one of the values of the gospel. The gospel has gone out to all nations. The Spirit has baptized every language. The kings of the nations are going to bring their treasures in, aren't they? To the temple, into the new heavens and earth. So every culture of every nation, once sanctified, is now a worthy means by which to praise God. And God, in fact, loves that distinctiveness and difference. He's looking forward to the end of time when people will still be of every tribe and every nation worshipping God together. And it's just as well that the New Testament doesn't despise human cultures of different kinds. Because if you are ever going to do anything, even singing a song, for instance, it's going to certainly reflect some human culture or other, isn't it? Is bound to be the case. Even something as plain and simple as singing an unaccompanied psalm, for instance. You can't get more plain and simple than that, can you? Yet, if you listen to a Wee Free Presbyterian church on the Isle of Orkney, it would sound very different to, say, a Coptic church in Egypt. They will sound very different, and no one or the other is more authentic or Christian than the other. Once you start allowing for things like musical instruments and that sort of thing, well, the variations become endless, don't they? So we don't think that this can be upheld by simply manifesting one culture. That's what Islam does, the culture of 7th century Arabia, but not what Christianity does. So I don't think the distinction is merely about whether something is classic or contemporary in style. As far as I can see, those are just different cultures. No one kind of music is inherently more or less holy than another. It depends on what you do with it. In the same way, no one kind of architecture is more or less holy than another. It depends what you do in it. God isn't calling us to freeze-frame our churches in the style of one particular time and era. And I think that's a very unwise thing to do, because then we lose the ability to relate to those outside. Now, I think the principle of through Jesus in spirit and in truth operates at a rather deeper level than simply the style of musical instruments or architecture in which we operate. Think again of what the pagans were trying to do in Canaan. They were substituting a man-made image or experience for the real thing of God himself. And at that level, the world's culture, the world's idols, can indeed unhealthily affect what we do in churches. At that level of substituting the real thing for a mere experience or something that's been set up or generated by human efforts. Let's consider, for instance, the funeral service of the late Pope. Now, I wasn't actually there. My invitation must have got lost in the post, I'm afraid. I don't know what happened to it. I'm told that it was a grand and magnificent spectacle. The incense soaring into the dome of the basilica above, the cardinals in their robes, the high culture and aesthetic beauty of the thing. I'm sure it created an immense impression on everyone there. I'm sure it was impossible to be there without a real tingle in your spine at such a magnificent occasion. But the question we must ask is, was it an authentic worship of God through Jesus in spirit and in truth? Or was it simply a grand and magnificent spectacle of human glory? But then, you're here sitting in a free church tonight, a converted office building. And I suspect that if you didn't agree with me, you'd probably be in the cathedral now anyway. But the temptation is there in lowbrow culture as well, isn't it? As well as in highbrow culture. It's quite possible to be tempted to, to manipulate the worship experience. I've got no objection to modern songs. We're going to sing a few in a moment. In fact, I think many of them are really crackingly good, many modern songs. Yet it is true that the way in which contemporary Christian worship is presented, put across very often, there are very real ways in which I think there's a danger of absorbing the world's culture in doing things. Let me give you some examples. For instance, our worldly culture at the moment prefers experience over content. Philosophically, it's essentially romantic. It's philosophical romanticism, all about engaging with some real sense inside you rather than thinking about something first. And it seems to me there's a real risk of being taken in by that. That can happen when musical worship goes straight for the heart without first going for the head. Do you know what I mean? When by the style of music and the words of songs, they're launching straight into the touchy-feelies and the warm fuzzies and the spine tinglies without the content and the truth being offered as to why we should be feeling that way. That's how God truly engages with our emotions, isn't it? By proclaiming the truth to us so that we respond, wow. But it's very easy to take the shortcut and just whip up a scenario and make people feel a certain way because a certain style of music presses buttons. It can be a kind of manipulation, and we're all vulnerable to it. Another example is the cult of the celebrity. The rock star image. I mean, celebrities are really important these days, aren't they? Everyone is supposed to be interested in them. The old-fashioned church choral music style no doubt appealed to cultural elitism. But the danger of a more popular style is that a music group on the stage become virtually indistinguishable from a rock concert, a rock band. And we know that can happen, don't we? And I've been on occasions where the music group has been meant to help the congregation singing. That's exactly what they're wanting to do. I'm not saying this is conscious on their part. But the fact is, if you crept over and unplugged them, the whole place would become very, very quiet. Because not many other people were singing along with them. It was more of a performance. Don't get me wrong. I have got nothing wrong, no objection at all to Christian choirs at the posh end or Christian rock bands at the common end. No problem with either of them performing their music, but not instead of corporate worship in the church. Apart from anything else, man-made substitutes for the real thing, the real engagement with God, can very easily pall, very easily become a bit tired and empty. They don't really satisfy the soul if you're really looking to worship in spirit and in truth and engage with God. Instead, you just need something a little bit more extreme to tickle your fancy. I'll give you an example. In my own experience, maybe this was just me, but it seemed this way to me. A few years ago, I went to a well-known Christian convention, and it was attended by thousands of people. And I was really looking forward to the chance to sing with thousands of brothers and sisters, to be reminded of what heaven would be like in that great big tent, and to learn a few good songs or two. And yet when I got there, and we went to that first meeting, well, it was very spectacular indeed. Huge stage, impressive professional band, amazing music, video screen with dazzling pictures. People had put in immense effort, and there were the people dancing around with the flags, and somebody doing an inspirational painting on the side, and this, that, and the other, all kinds of things. And frankly, it left me completely cold. Some of it was a bit embarrassing. They were trying to do stuff that happens at a rock concert, but not half as well. I'd rather have gone to a rock concert and been impressed. I'm sure they were sincere. I don't take it, you know, I'm not accusing them of not being Christians or anything like that. But I dread to say as well, after 5 minutes, it was boring too. Maybe I was the problem. Maybe it was me. Maybe I was just being too uptight or something like that, but I don't think so. I really felt that the heart had gone out of it, that the spirit and truth of authentic worship of God have been swamped by razzmatazz, by trying to dress it up because people wouldn't be impressed by the real thing. Yet, I've had some pretty disappointing experiences at the other end of the spectrum too, I have to say. I recall one village chapel where I preached in my trainee days. It was a long way away from here, I hasten to add. It was a very reformed church. There were no frills or fancies at all. Each seat had the 5 points of Calvinism printed on the seat in front of you. I've no objection to the 5 points of Calvinism, actually. I happen to believe them. But I don't feel the need to print them on the back of every chair, as if the greatest blessing you can have, the first thing you see as you walk in, is total depravity. I just don't think that's where we should quite start. The congregation was not small as village chapels go. There were at least 20 people there. But sad to say, it was not a blessing. At least I didn't find it a blessing to be there. It pains me to say it, but the people seemed to be cardboard cutouts. They really did. Stiff and starched and frigid. There wasn't a hint of response to anything I said or did. And more to the point, you couldn't detect a hint of joy in what Christ had done for them either. They could turn the grandest of him into a dirge. It was a trial for me, and I suspect it was utter misery for them too. Maybe they, because they didn't believe in purgatory after death, they were putting themselves before it, I don't know. Or maybe the problem was me again. It might have been. I maybe led in a grossly unsensitive way, and they were quite rightly turned off, maybe. Perhaps could have been so. But we all know that even if that wasn't true of that particular group of brothers and sisters, and it was all my fault, we all know that services like that do take place, don't they? And they make them deadly dull. Authentic worship is through Christ, in spirit and in truth. And yes, of course, that means reverence of God. It means not substituting man-made experience and shows for the real thing, for really engaging with him. Yet it's equally important, equally scriptural, that authentic worship should express authentic joy. And I find it hard to believe that you can express authentic joy without smiling, at least. Notice how often rejoicing features in this chapter. Verse 7. There in the presence of the Lord your God, you and your family should eat and shall rejoice in everything you have put your hands to, because the Lord your God has blessed you. Verse 12. There rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons and daughters, your men servants and maid servants, and the Levites and so on. And again on in verse 18, you are to eat your sacrifices in the presence of the Lord your God at the place the Lord your God will choose, skipping on to the end, and you are to rejoice before the Lord your God in everything you put your hand to. You cannot take worship too seriously, but you can make worship too serious, can't you? And it seems to me that a fearful rectitude amongst the brothers and sisters in that particular church had squeezed out any sense of grace or joy in what they were there to celebrate. So biblical worship, in spirit and truth, is exclusive. It is authentic, both in its reverence and in its rejoicing. And finally, it is united. And unity was a concern of God, verse 8. You're not to do as we do here today, everybody as he sees fit, since you've not yet reached the resting place and the inheritance your God is giving you. So they were doing their own thing as they travelled through the desert, but once they reached the land, they couldn't do as they see fit. They had to all conform to the God-given pattern. Nowadays, of course, we see so much variation around the churches, even in one city today, and we see worship becoming a focus for division, don't we? Is there any way in which we could regain a sense of unity and keep our worship authentic and express true reverence and rejoicing without using man-made substitutes and so on? The classic Reformed approach to this is what is called the regulative principle. Regulative principle. I don't know if you're familiar with that, and my chance to try and educate you this afternoon. That says that we should only ever do in Christian services things explicitly mandated of us in the New Testament, things which the Bible actually positively tells us to do. Sing praises to God and to each other, read the scriptures, preach and teach, pray, share the Lord's Supper. If we just stick to what the New Testament actually tells us to do, surely there is no way we can overstep the mark. And I've got a lot of sympathy for that, I have to say. I can understand the principle, and I see the attraction. Wouldn't it be such a principle ensure a degree of unity amongst Christian believers, if everyone agreed to it? But in the end, I'm not convinced that that is quite what the New Testament actually mandates upon us, I have to say. It certainly tells us that corporate time will include those things, that they are central, the heart and the essence of Christian worship. There's no doubt about that. But I'm not sure it actually draws a totally clear-cut rule in every circumstance. Interestingly, among my Reformed friends who take this view, there is considerable disagreement nonetheless as to where the line should actually fall. Some say you should sing only psalms, and others say you should sing hymns too, as long as they're long. I've never quite understood why they have to be long and not short, but that's one of the rules. Some say that you should sing unaccompanied. After all, the New Testament makes no mention of musical instruments in church. Sing and make music in your heart. Others say, well, it's fine to have musical instruments. And all of them, it seems to me, seem happy to pray in a seated position. The Bible never says pray sitting down. The Bible says pray kneeling, prostrate on the floor, or standing. Never sitting. And yet people willing to sit often are uncomfortable when someone else raises their hands. The Bible says we should raise our hands, doesn't it? 1 Timothy chapter 2. So I'm sure that many people here do uphold this principle. I'm going to take a little bit more persuading that you can actually tie biblical worship down quite as tightly as that. I don't think that the spirit and the truth that Jesus Christ talked about are fully represented by the regulative principle alone. No doubt you'll want to come and argue that out with me. But I certainly agree that Christian worship is not a free-for-all. Anything goes as long as there's not a rule against it either. Spirit and truth require us to exercise careful discretion in what we do. Here, for what it's worth, are some guidelines that I try to work along, just some of them, in leading worship. We should ensure that the simple, unadorned New Testament essentials remain central to our worship together. The singing of God's praises, reading the scriptures, preaching and teaching them, praying together, the Lord's Supper. They're the heart of what our church is about. If we see the need or the opportunity to, from time to time, include things in our services that aren't quite like that, well, I feel free to do that, but they should never usurp the essence of what worship is about. They should never replace them. A humorous story, an interview, a visual aid, a dramatic sketch or carefully used technology, they have a place, I think, in helping us communicate one to another, helping us explain how the truth is relevant to us and what God is saying in his word. But I don't think they substitute for direct speech to God. We should see that the music ministry of our church is, broadly speaking, an aspect of our word ministry, rather than a thing in its own right. Of course, a different person might lead distinct parts of the service. But I don't find in the New Testament this category of leader called worship leader, as if that's some sort of separate ministry that God has created distinctively. I think in an authentic Christian church, the word leads the music, not the other way around. Remember, our songs are an extremely important part of our teaching, aren't they? Who are the most influential theologians in the UK church today? Who are the ones who really make the most difference to what Christians actually think and believe and do. I'll tell you some of their names. Graham Kendrick, Matt Redman, Stuart Townend. That sort of name. The modern worship song writers. And I tell you, a lot of their stuff really is very, very good, I have to say. I'm not criticizing them, but we must recognize that and use them with discretion. And I reckon that Charles Wesley had a lot more long-term influence on popular theology than John Wesley ever did. So we need to ensure that our music ministry exists to support the congregation in their singing, rather than replace it or let it become an end in itself. That's why we have the musical instruments. They play so wonderfully, to help us all sing together in our praise of God. And the same goes for all the other paraphernalia of church life. Even things like decor and flower arranging and using PowerPoint and all of that kind of thing. They're there to support us to do the real thing, not to get in the way or squeeze them out. We should ensure that our services are open to the expression of genuine, heartfelt response to God, both reverence and rejoicing. But notice, as a response to the truth of his word, not the beginning or the end in its own right. And we should ensure that our worship together is a corporate thing too. The shared experience of a community, not a bunch of individuals, each privately worshipping in their own little box. And both conservative and contemporary styles can fall into that trap too. Notice how communal worship in Israel was to be. All over the place we find, for instance, verse 12, "There rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons and daughters, your men servants and maid servants, and the Levites from your towns, who have no allotment among the inheritance of their own." Worship served to draw together the whole of the community of God and build that sense of communal love together in the presence of God. And I could say more, and I freely admit that we don't do all these things perfectly. But I hope that's the direction that we're heading in. Meanwhile, I'm comforted by the grace and the love of our God. And we should certainly never think that true unity in worship could ever be achieved by mere outward conformity to a certain pattern. As if someday someone could produce the authentic, complete hymn book that solved all of these questions and dilemmas or anything like that. No. Inner reality is what counts. Spirit and truth expressed in the diverse expression of human character. True Christian maturity is not reflected by a narrowing down of what we find acceptable, but by a broadening out of it. Providing the truth and the spirit are right, that's what counts, that the truth and the spirit are right. It actually should matter to us less and less precisely how it's expressed. At that conference where the slick, fancy main meeting was a great disappointment to me, there were regular Bible readings too, very good ones, which 1,000 people packed into the big top. Before the first of these, a young man stood up on stage with a microphone and his guitar, looking slightly fumbly and awkward. Forgive me if I'm a little underprepared, he said. I was only asked to do this half an hour ago. Shall I lead us in prayer? And then we'll sing. And with that, this man read a few Bible verses, he said a prayer, and then we sung together two or three songs before hearing the Bible reading together. And you know what? That was the real thing. That was the real thing. And I, from then on, lost interest in the evening rock concert. And I looked forward instead each morning to real worship of our God. One man and his guitar, dwarfed on this giant stage, with 1,000 people singing their praise to God. And last Sunday evening, I went to preach at another little village chapel, a little Reformed church in a tin hut down the lane. Superficially, not that different from the other one that I mentioned earlier. But when we read about the glory and the majesty of God, about the sacrifice of Jesus, they nodded their heads seriously. You knew this mattered to them. And when we read about the wonder and the joy of salvation and being Christians and the privilege we've got of praying to him, well, their faces lit up joyfully. People smiled and laughed. And when they sing, it is incredible. Close your eyes. You could believe there are 300 people there. One day the roof of Saxingham Chapel is going to land on top of us, you know, because they have sung it off. The reverence for God and the rejoicing together as a community, you could feel it in the air. 15 people, most of them old ladies, in a little metal hut. So here we have this humble, self-effacing chap with the guitar, reads a verse, says a prayer, then helps 1,000 people sing songs like they really mean it this time. And there we have 15 people singing the hut off an old tin chapel. Both very different. Neither of them very spectacular or polished or professional. But done in the spirit and in the truth. And in our worship, Lord, give us more of your spirit and truth. Lord, give us more of you.